Welcome to the Out of Chicago podcast. I'm Chris Smith, and I am here with my good friend Rick Salmon. Again, thank you, Rick, for coming on.
Well, thank you. You know, your audience isn't seeing you. They're just hearing you, right? But I can see from your body language how excited you are about being the host of this great podcast. So good for you, my friend.
Well, I appreciate it. I love it because I've gotten to make friends with people like you and all these other people, and it's been a ton of fun. So thank you very much, and thanks for coming on. Now, today, Rick has brought with him one of his other friends. It's Bob Simpson, right? Tell us about Bob here. Tell us what we're going to be hearing.
Well, Bob's going to be listening to this, so I'm going to say his unofficial title is part-time Zodiac driver in Antarctica, because the picture he sent me of him shows him driving a Zodiac. But his official title is Vice President Expedition Cruising, Abercrombie & Kent, USA, which is, you know, A&K is like the world leader in luxury travel. So Susan and I are going down, my wife Susan and I, who you met at out of Chicago, we're going down to Antarctica, the Falklands, and South Georgia on one of their ships to teach photography in December.
Wow.
And so I'm teaching, you know, digital SLR photography and mirrorless photography, and Susan's teaching iPhone photography. And I got to tell you, you've never been on a workshop with a Chris, right? But people come on my workshops because they want to learn from, you know, people call me the Godfather, right?
We do.
And they want to learn about the long lenses and HDR and, you know, all this Lightroom and Photoshop. Well, that's the first day. The second day, they're seeing what Susan's doing. And they're following her. Oh, she's taking the picture. She's got them in camera. She's uploading them. She's using Snapseed. We were out in the Grand Tetons, and we were at that place, the Snake River, where Ansel Adams took that famous picture. Mm-hmm. Well, she has an app. It might be in Snapseed. I don't know. It's called this feature is called the Ansel Effect. Guess who got the best picture right away?
So you stand in the right spot with the right effect, and that's all you need.
Yeah, now I did it too, but you know, I had to download my pictures, the HDR sequence, you know, control the brightness and the contrast and all the stuff, open it in Nick. Mm-hmm. Now I might be able to make a much larger enlargement, right? That's right.
It's amazing what you can do with the phones, though. And it's also amazing what you can do for editing them. And I think Canon is kind of bridging that gap where they're putting Wi-Fi in their cameras now, and you can go straight to your phone or your iPad with that. And that's kind of the way to do it, I think, if you want the best of both worlds.
Yeah, well, the new Canon mirrorless has built-in Wi-Fi, and I took the Canon 5D Mark IV to Iceland.
And that does as well, doesn't it? Or am I wrong?
It has, that has GPS in it. I'm not sure if it has, I think it might
I'm pretty
it.
Sure the 5D IV has GPS and Wi-Fi, yeah.
But the GPS is amazing because Scott Kelby was going up to Iceland about a month after I was there. And he wanted to know where to go. So guess who sent him the GPS coordinates?
Nice.
Right?
Exactly.
So the GPS feature of the Mark IV is really good. But we are excited about going to the bottom of the world. And now I am going to be teaching, you know, how to photograph the eye. And we're going to come back after this with some tips. We're not going to have the battle of the cold weather. But it gets pretty cold in Chicago, right? With snow.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We'll talk about some tips for shooting in cold weather for sure. Yeah, I told you before we came on here, I didn't want to do the battle because you know how your father had all these sayings. Well, my mother had one to pick your battles, and I'm not going to battle.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm leading a workshop with someone else, we do like the battle of the sunset tips, like, you know,
right.
Place the sun off center, look behind you, expose for the highlights, use a foreground element.
Yeah. Until someone runs out. That's right. That's how you win the battle, right?
So listen, I talk about in the interview with my friend Bob, again, VP over there at A&K, an excellent I think he looks like an excellent Zodiac driver. Let's take a listen to that
yet.
And come back, okay?
Very good. All right, here we go. Bob Simpson.
Hey, Bob, welcome to the show. How the heck are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Rick. How are you? I'm so happy to be with you this morning.
Well, listen, we did a webinar a couple of months ago about this fantastic expedition cruise down to Antarctica, the Falkland Islands, and South Georgia that I'm doing with you. And you know, I'm just so excited because the last two times I was there, I was on a Russian icebreaker. So I think your ship is a little different, right?
Yeah, a little bit. As you know, we've been operating in the Antarctic for many, many years, a little bit over 25 years. I've been involved with that for almost 20 of those years. So you and I were joking a little bit earlier about my expertise in the field and driving Zodiacs and all that. And while I have a lot of experience here, most of what I do is sort of making sure that everything runs properly. And I've got friends that you'll be with down south this December that if they heard me refer to myself as a Zodiac driver, they'll get a good laugh out of that.
Yeah, well, that's a nice picture of you driving the Zodiac.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. One of my good friends, Carol Walton, who you're going to be traveling with. I think her and I were in the boat together and she took that picture. So she'll get a good laugh at that as well. Yeah. Like I said, you know, we're very excited to have you and Susan on this trip in December. I'm Le Boreal, leading our photo enrichment program. And we'll have a lot of time today to kind of dive into that and talk a little bit about, you know, what you guys will be doing and especially when it comes to the photography. But like I said, you know, we've been operating in the Antarctic for a very long time. I don't need to tell you, it is a very special place. It's a really magical place. One that I can't think of a more ideal place in the world where photography is such an important part. That's not just the landscapes and the destination, but just the amazing ice and the colors and the wildlife, which is just such an amazing component. We'll talk a little bit about that as well in terms of the destination. But you know, just really looking forward to a fun and exciting season coming up.
Well, I like to make learning fun. You guys like to make your expedition cruises a lot of fun, but you also make these very, very educational. You know, this is my thing now. You know, I have 13 online classes, 37 books, I think. I think I sent you the last one. Actually, another one's coming out next week. I'll send it to you guys. But I think today, education is so important, and continuing education for people at all levels is important. So I'm happy to be, people might be surprised that I'm not only teaching people in the field how to get great pictures of the wildlife, the animals, the ship, the fellow passengers, and all this good stuff, but I'm giving four or five seminars on the ship, one on capturing the beauty of Antarctica, one on photographing wildlife around the world, another one on landscape and seascape photography, and just two more, picturing strangers in strange lands, my people photography, and then basic digital image processing. So I'm going to be busy down there. You know, I'm a little hyper, as I think you might have found out from our couple of our conversations, but I like to be busy, and I think the guests really want to learn. They just don't want to go. You know, I tell people I don't want to go to Hawaii and sit under a palm tree and drink a piña colada. It would be like, for me, a fate worse than death. It would. So yeah. I like to be busy, and that's one of the things I like about A&K. You could stay in your cabin or sit on the deck and look at the ice go by, but I think most of the people will come to the not only the photo seminars, but all the other seminars that you have by your naturalists on the ship.
Absolutely, and you're 100% correct. The most important thing for us is not just the education, but the intrinsic enrichment that guests experience. And again, I keep referring back to the magic of Antarctica, but it really is. And for those that haven't been, it's almost impossible for me, for someone who, and yourself as well, that have been many, many times, to even really describe it and to explain it. It's almost one of those things that it's not until you go that you actually get that sort of wow and aha moment. We had an old captain years ago that used to talk about that, and he used to say that, you know, the first time that he went to the Antarctic, it was like he got hit in the back of the head by a 2x4. It was that amazing and that much of a awakening experience that you just get. And of course, like I said, the education and the enrichment is such a big part of it, of that. But also for us as a company,
you know, again, we've been doing this for many, many years. You know, as an operator within IATO, which is the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, that we're a full member and have been for going on 25 years, that it's our obligation and responsibility to not just to deliver the destination to the guests, but to make sure that we do it in a very responsible way. And when they come back, that in many ways they've sort of become ambassadors for the destination. What a better way to exhibit that but by their photography and the things that they can show their friends when they get back.
Yeah, and I think that applies to a lot of places we go. You know my friend Jonathan Scott, right? The big cat man. Yes. I've been, and he works with ANK on the Round the World trip. I think you stop in Kenya and he gives a talk for a few days. But anyway, one of the things I love about Jonathan is he really stresses the importance of not only respecting the wildlife, but respecting the environment. Because if you don't respect the environment, you know, what's going to happen to the wildlife? So
Absolutely. In
Antarctica, I know you guys do that, and that's so important to do. But getting back to that wow factor, you know, I went there the first time to photograph the wildlife. I really wanted to get nice wildlife shots. But man, oh man, exactly what you're saying is true. That blue ice, when you see these, you know, icebergs, you know, some is, you know, bigger than a city block or some smaller ones, and all these shapes and forms and all different shades of blue backlit, you know, at sunrise or sunset, you really can't describe that. Just like, you know, getting back to Jonathan Scott. In Africa, you know, if you see a kill, right, you feel sorry maybe for the baby giraffe killed by the lions, but you know, the lion cubs have to eat, right? So I say no one comes back from Africa unchanged, and I think it's the same in Antarctica. No one comes back unchanged, but it's so hard to describe that awe-inspiring experience, which is why some people say for a lifetime to go, right?
Absolutely, and the lands, the scale, and the landscapes are just out of this world. And when we go to places that you'll be going with the guests as well, to South Georgia, where you're you know, on shore in a Salisbury Plain, right, a king penguin rookery, that you have. About a half a million, literally a half a million, 250,000 pair, breeding pair of these beautiful, colorful, 3-foot birds that are completely unaffected by our being there, number one. But it literally, as far as your eye can see, you just see nothing but the colony. And what I always find, for me, I'm a very sensorial person. I'm not sure if that's
there
a word
go.
Or not.
It's good enough for the podcast.
Okay. But when I see, and I've been there so many times, but when I see these pictures, I can smell and hear, and it brings it all back. And I just can't think of another place in the world that's like that. And when we talk about the wildlife, there's another thing that I think is really sort of interesting. You know, we have an obligation, again, as an operating member of IATA, we follow very strict environmental guidelines and responsibilities that are set forth by the Antarctic Treaty System for any activities in Antarctica, including tourism. And part of that has to do with the wildlife and the interaction with wildlife. So as a passenger on shore, I'm not able to, in any threatening way, approach wildlife within a 15-foot sort of parameter. Right. Okay, it has to be done very carefully and sensitively. However, and we always say this, the wildlife are not under the same obligation of that rule.
Yeah, so they could come to you.
Absolutely. You sit down on a beach somewhere, you put your camera bag next to you, and you're going to have penguins digging into your bag, crawling over your there's no problem with that. They're completely unaffected by us being there. And part of that is because there is no natural land-based predation or predators and haven't for millions of years. So they don't have any innate or instinctual fear. They see us walking around in our red, yellow parkas. We're just big red birds.
Well, it's, like in the Galapagos, right? You guys, run trips to Galapagos. But, you know, just a couple of quick tips on, you know, photographing like that emperor penguin colony. But before I say I talk about that, the first thing you mentioned is when you're talking about all these penguins, you mentioned the, if I could rewind the podcast, it would be the smell. So like millions of penguins don't smell that great. But anyway, the tip is that, you know, try to tell the whole story for our listeners who are going to go down there. Take the wide angle shot. Take the medium shot. Take a shot of you or have someone take a shot of you, you know, photographing or exploring the you know, this beautiful area, and then go for the close-ups. And if I were, or what I'm going to be doing when I'm down there, I'm going to be shooting on the aperture priority mode because depth of field is so very important. So for the wide angle shot, I'm going to be shooting at a small aperture to get the entire scene in focus. But for maybe, you know the shot, Bob, everybody wants, you know, the mommy and the daddy with the little penguin in between, right? I actually have a shot like that from before, but I really want to get that again. So for that, I'm going to be using, you know, a telephoto zoom with a wide aperture to blur the distracting background. But, you know, I just can't.
Rick, that's, and that's why we have you and Susan on, because thank God, because I am not an expert in that field. And again, this being such an important part of the experience, having you on to be able to make sure that people are getting that kind of guidance and information in the field and through the course of the trip. Everybody, you know, we talk a little bit about that whole sort of education. And as you mentioned earlier in the discussion, that, you know, it's not obviously just about photography. We have a wide ranging enrichment sort of platform that we organize and deliver when we're down there, on history, on marine mammals, on ornithology. We talk about the birds, obviously, the ice and glaciology, geology, things of that nature. But years ago, we recognized, as, and especially as technology really sort of has continued to just take off and develop, how important photography is as an educational and enrichment experience. And so that's when we implemented, this is going on 10 years now, that we determined that photography is one of the most important deliverables that we can address. And so we created sort of this sort of platform that you're going to be managing and delivering is on photography, and making sure that the guests are getting the best out of that. I've told you, I think, this story in the past. The first time I went to Antarctica, I don't even think digital cameras, I'm not sure if they were even invented yet, but back then it was all rolls of film.
Right.
You know, people still had the advanced equipment and all that. But you know what?
You never knew.
You had the rolls of film were like gold. And towards the end of the trip, there was a black market on board the ship on getting additional film, because people started running out. The first time you go to that penguin colony, you snap three rolls of film before you even know it. And, you know, nowadays there's so much ability to be able to manage the photos and during onboard the ship. And that, and I know that's a lot of what you're going to be, you know, kind of covering as well, is, you know, how to manage the files and what to do with the images, and how to, you know, Photoshop and all that, those things that I know nothing about. But I think that's going to be a key part too.
Well, you know, you could spend long books have been written about all this stuff. But one of the things I like to do, as my friend Chris Smith from out of Chicago and out in New York knows, you know, I like to make learning fun. I like to make learning simple. So even someone who's never used Photoshop or Lightroom will be able to get good pictures. And I stress to all my workshop students, I say, don't delete your pictures, because it's amazing what we can do today. It's amazing what we can do today in the digital darkroom. But who knows years from now what all the great possibilities. And also, I tell people, I think some of our listeners may have heard this before, but I say, don't delete an out-of-focus picture. And they always say, why? I say, well, one out-of-focus picture is a mistake. 20 out-of-focus pictures is a style. So don't delete your out-of-focus pictures. But listen, I'd love to get back to the boat. As I said, Russian icebreaker last time, a little humble. This new ship looks pretty nice. As Larry David would say, don't know if you watch him, but he would say, pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, things have, like I said, not only has the world of technology with cameras and film changed, but the world of technology with our ships has changed as well. I get a chuckle when you talk about, the difference between, there's a couple of things. One is the end experience.
Yeah.
I can go down there on a tugboat.
Right.
And I'm gonna have an amazing experience. But more and more, our guests have become a bit more accustomed to some of the more levels of comfort and sort of luxury amenities and things of that nature. And like I said, I've been doing this a long time. I've been down there on a lot of ships, different types of ships, just a few sizes, style, whatever. We started the ship that you'll be on, the La Boreal. The ship has a capacity of 264 guests on board, so it's not a large ship, but it's a sort of medium size. But it was built, as all the ships that we operate in the Antarctic. We also do trips on the sister ship La Lirial, which you'll probably see down there at some point as well. That's exactly the same, but the La Boreal, La Lirial, the ships that we use, there's a very specific sort of requirement that we have. First of all, in terms of the operational capacity, things that we can do, what's important to our guests, the ease of getting off on and off the ship. And, through our webinar that we did that you mentioned a couple months ago, we showed a little bit about sort of that Zodiac operation. And of course, everything is done by our fleet of Zodiacs, and we have our staff naturalists that are the ones driving the boats and with the guests out in the field. But on board as well, the ability for us to continue the education process, in the theater. We have a beautiful, beautiful theater that seats everybody, state of the art.
That looks like an IMAX. It's not as big as an IMAX, but yeah. Boy, oh boy, that is. I have presented at IMAX theaters, but I cannot wait to present in that theater. My gosh.
Very nice, very comfortable, and just the overall amenities. I mentioned this, the capacity 264. We limit our capacity when we operate in the Antarctic to no more than 199 passengers. We want to stay below the 200 passenger number, and there's two reasons why. One is that, as I mentioned, we're a member of IATO and following the Antarctic Treaty requirements. There's a number of different categories of operation in the Antarctic, and there's a bunch of different sizes of ships and numbers of passengers that are on board ships and that. And the two primary categories are Category 1 and Category 2. Category 1 are the ships that are under 200 passengers. Category 2 are ships that carry over 200 passengers.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but are still able to land passengers. The difference, though, is there's roughly between 106 to 110 specific landing sites within the Antarctic Peninsula, which is, for Antarctica, for us, is the main area that we're sort of in operating. Of those sites, there's a specific number of those that are available for Category 1 vessels. Category 1 vessels can go to all of the recognized landing sites. For Category 2 vessels, there's only about 30% of the sites that are permitted for that number of passengers that are on the ship. So as a Category 1 operator, it gives us the ability for a wider range of operation, more opportunities, more flexibility. Things change, as down there, with weather and ice and, conditions that sort of dictate what we end up doing. A lot of times I do our scheduling. I schedule what we're planning to do for your trip in December. I did that back at the end of June, right? So I went into the system and secured the landing sites that we have planned and set up. Well, I can't control what happens in December with weather and ice, right, and things like that. So a lot of times we have to make changes and adapt to the conditions. And that's another sort of valuable piece of the experience that we have on board with our expedition team and our expedition leader and the staff in knowing, alternative, sort of opportunities. But so it gives us a little bit more of a flexibility. The other thing is that the La Boreal, and you'll see it when you get on board, most of the cabins on board are balcony cabins. There are a number of cabins that don't have the full balcony. That those are the cabins that we use for our expedition staff and team. So all of the guests that come on the ship have their own private balcony, and there's really no other ship that that can offer that currently in terms of Antarctica. We have a nice spa. We've got a beautiful panoramic sort of view workout facility that's on the ship. So a lot of these things that you and I didn't have on some of the earlier model ships that are available. And I tell you, it's nice to be back on board the ship sometimes just to decompress and relax.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got space to do so, because again, a ship carrying 264 passengers, if I lower that to under 200, I right away, that's 30%, roughly 30% of the additional passengers the ship is designed to carry that aren't on board the ship. So you have a much better feeling of space, and that's on board the in the public areas, but also out on deck. And you're going to talk a lot about, I think, the value of being out on deck whenever you can, even when we're at sea. The seabird photography and the whale encounters that we're likely to have. There's always something going on. So
and that blue
our passengers, yeah. Right? And we always say have your parka and your camera in an easiest place that you can grab and go, because you're constantly on the go, going out and taking pictures of things that just spontaneously will come up. So
do you guys make an announcement?
It's a great platform, just such a great platform for what we do down there.
Do you guys make an announcement, like if a pod of whales surfaces off to the port side? Yeah. That's
absolutely, absolutely. Not only that, we have a captain who. Captain Garcia, who you'll have a ball traveling with, and he's one of my great, great friends. There's not a person that I know that is more enthusiastic about whales. So he will do everything he can to change course, to get to the ship position so that guests have that opportunity for the whale watching encounters. So it's just an amazing, amazing experience.
Just a quick tip for shooting the ice. I always bring a polarizing filter with me, and a polarizing filter really doesn't do much when you're shooting into the sun or away from the sun. But when the sun's off to the left or the right, it's really important. And you have that glare on the ice, and you don't want to blow out any details in that blue ice or the white ice or in the sparkling water. So I always say to my students, I say, shoot with your highlight alert on your camera, and I'll explain this to the guest, and your histogram. Have them activated. So, Bob, we talked about the ship. We have a couple of minutes left here. When I was there the first time I went, I was concerned about one thing that a lot of people, I think, going to Antarctica are concerned with, and it's about getting seasick over the Drake's Passage. I was talking to someone yesterday, and they call it the Drake Shake. Now, my nephew, Dr. Jesse Irwin, he's a practicing, I think, emergency room doctor now. He was a doctor on an aircraft carrier, and he would recommend to the sailors to eat candied, now I'm not a doctor, so I'm just passing this along, eat candied ginger a lot and eat Skittles. So I did this last time, and we had not really rough seas. We have 5 to 6 foot seas, which, as you know, for a ship like that is nothing. But there were some people getting sick. And I said, try the Skittles, and they felt better. So for me, I and that's what I told my wife, Susan, I said, eat the candy ginger, eat the Skittles. What are your recommendations?
Well, the folks at Mars Incorporated, I love that, endorsement of their Skittles. Yeah. Matter of fact, as an aside, I've operated trips in the Antarctic for the Mars company.
Really?
And in every time, yeah, absolutely. It's a whole different story, but and in those cases, we always had tons of Skittles on board. It's a good question, and nor am I a doctor as well. There's a couple of things. One is that it gets back sort of the technical capacity of the ship, and the stabilizing system and all that. The ship is designed specifically as a polar expedition cruise ship, and particularly with effort to operate in the Southern Ocean, which is a whole different sort of environment, obviously. But that said, Yes, there's times you're, especially in the Drake Passage and surrounding Southern Ocean. Geographically, as you know, the Antarctic as a continent, it's surrounded by water, right? So there's a circumpolar current that continues to circulate around the continent of the Antarctic. And it comes from east, from west to east, if you're looking at the, you know, from geographically, through that narrow sort of stretch of water between the southern tip of Argentina and the peninsula of the Antarctic, and that's the Drake Passage. So that notoriously, sort of historically, has been sort of a volatile area in terms of the sea conditions. So yes, it can, and every trip is different, obviously, but it can get a bit more rough. So full disclosure, I have never, ever, ever been seasick in my entire life. So this is not something that I even have a personal sort of frame of reference. However, one of our cruise directors, and I always get a kick out of this because he spent his life nearly at sea, he gets seasick like crazy. And he swears by it's a medication that you would have to go to a doctor if you do think that this is something that you might, you know, be concerned about, that you would have to get a prescription for, but it's called Sturgeon Forte, Sturgeon Forte is the name. And I think there's other sort of similar, you know, medications, whatever. I always recommend people that do either have a susceptibility for motion sickness or think that it might be a problem to go to their doctor ahead of time and ask. There's so many wide ranging different types of, you know, recommendations in medicine and all that. But I just throw that out there just because, again, a good friend of mine who is, you know, it's something that he deals with, and that's something that he swears by, and he has it all the time. Yeah. So that could be another good recommendation.
Yeah, I'm looking at that as we speak. That sounds kind of cool. Well, listen, we're getting near the end. If you could give us a person like one, I'll come back with a photo tip, but or I could start with a photo tip if you want. If you could give a person who's considering a trip to Antarctica, you know, one piece of advice or one suggestion or, you know, one thought, what would that be, Bob?
Just go. That's go. Good. Yeah, it really is. Like I said before, it is a life-changing experience. I am challenged to think of an instance, and I have sent and been with and dealt with literally thousands and thousands of passengers over the years that have gone to the Antarctic, and there's never been an occurrence, not one, where somebody came back and didn't say that it was the most amazing experience that they ever had. And I, quite frankly, you mentioned before, we're all over the world. Africa's our home. But I'm not sure if I can say that just about any other destination. I will say real quick, if anyone that's listening to our podcast today is interested to join Rick, we still do have a number of cabins that are available on the trip. Some of the categories that we have still some incentive for booking. So just go to Abercrombie & Kent's website, www.abercrombiekent.com, and you can get all the details. Feel free to contact us. You can contact me directly. I'll answer any questions or help as well. But yes, just go. Just go. At some point, you have to go.
Well, you know what? I'm going to follow it up with the tip for being down there photographing. Just shoot, right? You can get, you know, sometimes you get too bogged down in all the technical stuff, but I'll be there to help. But yeah, you want to capture your memories to relive this for a lot of people, right? A once-in-a-lifetime experience, and to, you know, relive that and to share with your family and with your friends. Well, Bob, it was a lot of fun. You're a great guest. Susan and I really look forward to being photo instructors down there at the bottom of the world, which is a very cool place to be. And we hope to have you on the show again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick. And happy to be here and happy to join you anytime.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thank you, Rick, for doing that. I wish I could join you on an adventure like this, but yeah, I mean, that's crazy. You guys are going, how long is the trip again?
I think it's a little more than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So we're flying from New York to Buenos Aires to the bottom of Argentina, getting on the ship and then going over to Antarctica, the Falklands and South Georgia.
Wow. No, that's going to be great. So you want to talk some cold weather shooting tips?
Yes, I will talk. I'll start with number one when you're photographing. Well, actually, number one would be have an extra battery with you. Because as you know, that cold weather sucks the life out of a battery. It happens with your car battery, too. So right. I have another battery and keep it inside a pocket where it stays nice and warm. So you don't run out of power when you're freezing your butt off.
That's right. And I know from shooting other mirrorless cameras that if you normally want to bring one extra battery with the mirrorless ones, and I'm guessing it's the same with the new Canon one, you want about six extra batteries. So with those, whatever it is, they're smaller, they don't last as long, but they'll go down a lot faster. So extra batteries, keep them warm.
So is there a way to conserve battery power, like not use the screen as much? But I know all the mirrorless, I think all the mirrorlesses use a lot of battery power.
Well, that's part of it. Well, see, they're trying to make them so small that they need small batteries. Otherwise, what's the point, I guess? And then you can't look through the viewfinder. They're continually playing live view, basically.
Right. It's
the only way to see on a mirrorless camera. There's no mirror to actually see through that way.
Well, another tip would be, you know, you really have to dress for these chilly conditions.
Right.
Susan, who I mentioned before, her hands get very cold. And you know, a lot of people's hands get cold. So she ordered these special gloves. Do you know Chris Klepek from Outdoor Photo Gear?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's a great guy.
Yep.
He sells these special gloves. If you look on the video, they're like sniper gloves. What happens is they're like mittens, and then the mitten folds back, and you have like a glove inside.
Yeah.
She has these, and I have these. And I have about three or four different types of gloves. I'm probably going to bring those and maybe two other pairs down there. So depending on how cold it is, but the idea is you want to have access. You want to have, you know, be able to access your camera controls without taking your gloves off.
Yeah, and I found if you're trying to make your holiday wish list of what you'd like coming up, that a pair of gloves is kind of the perfect thing. Most people can afford it, and you always have a couple extra pairs around for sure. So some good photography gloves.
Good gloves are important for cold weather shooting. You know, it's going to snow. You want to have some kind of camera covers. Now, in my back, and well, you listeners can't see, but behind me, I have like a whole drawer full of, you know, these super expensive that people send me these camera covers, right?
Yep.
You know, mm-hmm. $200. Well, I like the Optek. Have you seen these? The Optek plastic? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You know, it's like two for $10, I think.
Yeah, no, they're very cheap. Do you use that? Do you use them most of the time? Like, let's just say that it's snowing, not too hard. Do you feel that you want to put that on there, or you have all, you know, weather resistant?
Yeah, I still put them on there. We were in Yellowstone recently, and it was raining and snowing, mm-hmm. and someone had the old Canon. 100 to 400, the push pull. I mm-hmm. think that's sealed too, but I'm not sure.
But I think it is, but yeah.
But
it
feels still,
like it's sucking inside.
You know, you don't want to get some moisture in there. So I always have those. I always have those with me, even if it's sealed. I like to keep my camera controls. But you know, the more expensive the cameras, like with the Canon cameras, the more weather sealed it is.
Right, right. Speaking of moisture, how about dealing with your lenses and that fogging up in the winter? What do you do?
Well, this is a good point. Or it could happen in the summer too if you go from the air conditioning to outside. Basically, what you want to do is you always want to have a lens cleaning cloth with you, you know, microfiber cloth, which I always have with me. And, you know, this is a very small basic tip, but I think it's a good tip. Say you get dust or there's moisture on your lens. I see a lot of people just like trying to wipe it off, you know, just in a random pattern. But again, it's a small tip, but it makes a difference. You start from the middle. And you, in a circular motion, you move out. So you're basically moving what's in the middle to the outside. But what you don't want to do, whether you're going from hot to cold or cold to hot, is to change lenses.
That's right.
If you do that and your camera's like, we were in Miami and it was so humid out in the summer, and someone changed lenses outside after being in air conditioning for overnight, the mirror fogged up and their sensor fogged up, and they were done for the day.
Yeah, yeah. And really it could cause issues in the future. All that moisture inside of it causing, you know, over time would be really bad for it, or just the inside of the lens too.
Yeah.
So the last thing you ever want to do, I mean, and you're tempted, if it's in the winter and you go inside and it's all foggy, you're tempted to maybe put a different lens on or something that's not all fogged up. But what happens then is that humid, moist air gets inside the camera. And then when it condenses, it's on the inside of your camera and the inside of the lens.
So the tip would be, think about really seriously what lens, if you could only bring one lens, what would that be? You know, I just thought of something while we were talking about these cold weather tips. You know, behind me in my office, I have all these old cameras. And in the 80s, when I was shooting film, if you were going to a really cold climate, you would send your camera into the manufacturer and they would change the lubricants inside. So the parts move better, and they would change the oil or whatever the lubricants are inside. So that's one thing we don't have to do.
I mean, we think we're lucky that we've got so many more megapixels and everything else nowadays, or well, that it's digital at all. But the fact that these cameras can do well in those conditions.
Yeah. Okay. Another tip for shooting in the cold would be, you know, it's usually going to be snow around. I'd say always pack a polarizing filter. And if it's snowing, actually, a lot of people don't think about this. I think it's important. We were out in, again, Yellowstone, and we were photographed. This is September. So we were there a couple of weeks ago, actually 2 weeks ago. So it's like early September. It's early September, and it's snowing one morning. Very unusual. So we're photographing the bison, and people said, what tips do you have? Now, usually they say, hey, Rick, what's your f-stop, right? I get that a lot. By the way, Chris is very skilled at covering up a sneeze. In a podcast, he sneezed twice in the last 30 seconds.
And well, one of them I got, and one of them I think they heard. So,
yeah. No, I don't know. I didn't hear it. So anyway, when you're photographing in the snow and the rain, experiment with different shutter speeds, because if that snow is falling gradually, right, the shutter speed, if you use a slow shutter speed, it might streak too much through the subject, or you might want that effect.
That's right.
And use a fast shutter speed, you'll be able to see the snowflakes. Also, experiment with your aperture. Because we were photographing this bison that was maybe 50 yards away with the 100 to 400. And, you know, some people were shooting wide open and they got big flakes, you know, that obscured the bison. Whereas those of us who were shooting at smaller apertures, we were able to see the bison a little better.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about shooting in the winter, and especially when it's snowing, is how the snow can cover up so many other things. I have some shots from the Chicago Botanic Garden where you can see the trees with the snow on it, and you can see like this bench in the foreground, but everything else, like the rocks, excuse me, the signs and everything else, they are they're obscured by the snow. And that's one of the things as photographers that we're always trying to do is eliminate all those distractions. And the snow can really help you to do that.
Oh, and the way it curves. And, you know, it's nice to photograph snow at night, right? But yeah. Also during the day after snows when the sun's bright and the mm-hmm. blue sky. But you mentioned covering up things. I have a friend and it was snowy. He went outside and took a picture of his decorated Christmas tree. He put it on iStock. He made $30,000 selling that one picture. It was a very, very popular picture.
Wow, I guess so.
Yeah.
How about this? This is for a new photographer, someone that's just getting started. Because I remember when I started going out, I'm like, oh, I'm going to try shooting some pictures outside. And all of my pictures, it's snow all over the ground. All of my pictures turned out gray. What do I need to do?
Yeah, well, they came out gray and a little dark. Yeah, but it sounds backward that when you're photographing a subject with a lot of white in it, like snow or at the beach or bright water, you want to, if you're shooting on the AV mode, or which is the mode I shoot on, you want to use a plus one exposure compensation. So that sounds backwards. And if you're photographing a bison, getting back to our bison, just a full headshot where it's really dark, you want to give it a minus one. So, and if you're on manual, you just dial it, you know, plus or minus either way.
Right.
That's probably the biggest mistake people make. Oh, they have the automatic camera. It's going to give you a great exposure in all these different situations.
Right. And then, like you said, they go, oh, man, I don't have enough light in here, you know, and they're like, you know, or it's really, really bright. I better dial it back.
Right.
It's so bright. And then it gets even darker. The way I like to think of it is when you're shooting in the snow, you know, your picture should be really bright. So put it at +1 or whatever, to, you know, for your exposure compensation. And I shoot a lot at night. Well, you want those pictures to look dark. So if you're using that mode, you want to bring it down. You want them to look dark. So you got to, you know, be -1 or -1.5, whatever.
Well, I think that's just about all my cold weather shooting tips.
Thank you for not battling me. I appreciate it. But yeah, this was great. And I can't wait to hear about all your adventures down to Antarctica. It's going to be great. One of these days I'm going to join you. And
I hope so.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's going to be great. So really looking forward to it.
Well, thank you, my friend. I really look forward to if out of New York is anything like out of Chicago, it's going to be a great event.
Yeah, people are going to love it. Yeah, October 14th and 15th, you're going to be there. Lindsay Adler is going to be there. I'll mention it again that your classes, we're going to be opening them up free to the public. So even if you're not coming to the entire thing, you can come and see Rick. You can come and see Lindsay Adler, two amazing photographers, and even better than that, two amazing presenters. So that's going to be, and two great people. We love them both. So thank you, Rick. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for coming out of New York and for Chicago last year and everything else.
Well, thank you. And also, so if someone wants to come to these free seminars, do they just go to the Out of Chicago, Out of New York site, or shoot you an email, or me? They could shoot me an email, ricksalmon@me.com.
Yep. Or email me, chris@outofchicago.com, or just go to outofchicago.com, or actually we have it set up for New York, outofnewyork.com, and everything will be there for you to sign up.
Cool.
For sure. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, my friend. Take care.
You too. Talk to you soon.